Ready, set, vote. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. This hour, we'll see how early voting's going across the region as it gets underway. That's coming up. Then later, find out why the MOSH is on the move, the Museum of Science and History. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID pandemic. Florida added 50 more COVID-19 deaths Sunday. Four of them came from the Jacksonville area. And the numbers largely followed trends of the past week. Overall, hospitalizations are continuing to decline across Florida. Meanwhile, at the same time, the Douglas Anderson School of the Arts will be the second Duval County Public School to close its building completely this week and do at least a temporary switch to virtual school for all its students. That is due to a number of COVID cases at DA. We don't know how many exactly. I'm going to be checking on that this morning and find out. Now, the pandemic is the biggest issue this election, of course, as candidates for local and national office are nearing the final stretch of their campaigns. We've learned that Senator Kamala Harris will be here in Jacksonville later today campaigning for the Biden-Harris ticket. It's her first visit to Jacksonville in this campaign season. Reports of long lines, meanwhile, at early voting sites across the region. Early in-person voting begins today. It's the first day of early voting for the upcoming general election in Duval, Nassau, Clay, and St. John's counties. Early voting continues until October 31st in Clay and St. John's and through November 1st in Duval and Nassau counties. Now in Baker County, if you're listening there, early voting begins tomorrow and runs through Halloween. In just a few moments, we hope to hear from Duval County Supervisor of Elections Mike Hogan and get an update about early voting in the region. Because more than 2 million of you across Florida have already cast your ballot in the 2020 election, you voted by mail. But if you're planning to vote in person, we have some information for you as we welcome to the show Duval County Supervisor of Elections, Mike Hogan. Mike, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great, and thanks for giving us some time on this very busy day for you and your staff. We'll go to some...
I appreciate your opportunity. I'm sorry I was slow to get here. We have a lot of things going on.
I can certainly understand that. And if you have a question for Duval County Supervisor of Elections, Mike Hogan, give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is open. So we're seeing on social media people posting photos of long lines already, Mike, at early voting sites around Duval County. What are you seeing this morning?
Well, we've seen long lines in some places and just steady lines at others. But we do know this, we've already exceeded the first hour for 2016, and that was a pretty significant milestone for us. We expected a lot of traffic, and we were hoping for a lot of traffic. But people getting there at 5:30 was a surprise to many of us.
People started lining up at 5:30 this morning, really?
Yes, and yes, ma'am. And so I'm not sure what the reasoning was, but perhaps it worked out for them. Can't open, of course, till 7.
7 a.m., of course. How many people have already cast a ballot by mail in Duval County?
I could not tell you that. I've been out in the field and just got back to the EC. I haven't looked at anything yet. I was just visiting two of our sites, our early voting sites.
But certainly healthy interest in this election. And we're also getting questions from some listeners that they had planned to vote by mail, but they've changed their mind and they're now going to vote in person. If someone had already requested a ballot by mail, but they want to come vote in person this week or next, what's the process to make sure that their vote gets counted?
Well, absolutely. They can vote in person. The only thing that they question is, do I have to bring my ballot with me, my mail ballot with me? And they don't. They can destroy the mail ballot, and that's fine. Or if they bring it, then it will be destroyed there. They'll have to, just tear in front of the officer or give it to our officer, and they will tear it.
There are early voting sites, Mike, that you've set up across Duval County, and they also have drop boxes where people could drop their mail ballot. Can you tell us more about how that side of this works?
Sure. We have 20 sites. That's the most we've ever had. And this is the first time we've been using drop boxes. Every site has a drop box. All the drop boxes are outside except for one office, one site, I should say, and that is Bradham Brooks. There's just not a place to put it outside. And so it's inside the polling room. But people can go avoid the line and just go right on in and drop their ballot off in the box inside. Five of the sites have drive-thrus. Legends, let's see, Mandarin, Torrey Road, Corey Road, West Regional, Beaches Regional, and I'm missing one. Did I say Prime Osborne?
Okay. And DuvalElections.com is
on the homepage. Yes.
Yeah. People can look at your website, DuvalElections.com, for more. And if you're in St. John's, Nassau, Baker, Clay, check your Supervisor of Elections website. We'll go to your calls in a moment. For Duval's Super of Elections, Mike Hogan, the number to join us is 549-2937. Mike, let me ask you about the drop boxes. Secretary of State Laurel Lee sent guidance to election supervisors around Florida saying that mandatory drop boxes must be staffed by election officials at all times. This is new guidance that just came out, and that these officials have to ensure that each voter has signed and sealed their ballot envelope. The guidance also says discretionary drop boxes may only remain open during early voting days and hours. This guidance has been criticized by experts in Florida election law. They say the law does not require these drop boxes to be staffed at all times. Some supervisors of elections around Florida say they're basically going to ignore this guidance. What's going to happen with this guidance in Duval County?
Well, we had heard that some months ago. So we have two deputies at every box, and we're open for business 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., and that coincides with the hours of early voting, and we're only, those boxes are only out during early voting, except at our home office, as you know, 105 East Monroe Street. That's a 24-hour, 7 days a week drop slot there. And we did have, and we have right now, because early voting is taking place there, a box outside the office for people to walk up and drop their box, their mail ballots in.
Let's go to some calls now. It's the first day of early voting. How do you plan to vote this election? 549-2937 as we speak with Duval County Supervisor of Elections Mike Hogan. Lisa is in Riverside. Hi, Lisa. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for doing this show. First, I wanted to say my father did a vote by mail and had a very good experience. He was able to track it to make sure it was counted, and as far as he's been able to see, it was counted, so that was great. I wanted to know, I'm thinking about doing early voting, and I wanted to know if I come to my library and vote, is there a way for me to track and make sure that my vote is counted?
Sure, Lisa, thanks. Mike Hogan, tracking your ballot.
Yes, ma'am. That's also on our homepage, on our website, but it's ballot tracking. The easiest way to get there is when you get to the homepage, click on My Voter Status. It only asks you three questions, basically, your first name, your last name, and your date of birth. The key is the date of birth has to be formatted correctly. Then you'll say, I'm not a robot. Check that box and then submit. It'll take you directly to all of your personal data, including ballot tracking. Now, we only track when it's in our hands. So we will tell you that we've sent it. We will tell you that we've received it. And we will tell you that it's been verified and it's ready to count. We can't tell you where it is in the mail stream as it relates to your house or whether it's coming back to us and it's lost. We don't have anything to do with the United States Postal Service tracking. That's just our tracking when we have it in our possession.
There have, of course, been a lot of concerns raised about slowdowns at the Postal Service. What are you hearing on your end? Are mail-in ballots coming into you in a timely manner around the area?
Oh, yes. We sent out the domestics on our, September 24th, and we got them back, many back the next day. The voter got their ballot the very next day. And so, yes, everything we've seen has been very swift. We just have not had the problems with the Postal Service that you hear about around the country. But Jacksonville is a hub, and that that's a benefit to our citizens.
That's interesting to note. Lots of tweets coming into the show as we speak with Duval County Supervisor of Elections Mike Hogan. If you're just tuning in, today's the first day of early voting for much of the region. You've got a couple of weeks to cast a ballot in person if that is your choice. You could always vote on Election Day, too, which is November 3rd. Brian tweets the show, just to let voters know, the line at the Beaches Library this morning was long, but it moved steadily. He says, a very well-run operation. Brian, thanks for that report from the Beaches. What are your thoughts and questions about casting your ballot this historic election? It's 549-2937. We're getting calls about all kinds of issues, including whether your signature might not match. That's something a lot of voters ask about. Stephanie is at the Beaches. Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Yeah.
Hi, Stephanie. You're on the air.
Great. My question for Mr. Hogan, I have a mail-in ballot, and I wanted to drop it off at the Beaches location, and I just wanted to fill it out so I didn't have to wait in line and make it more efficient. My concern is my signature is from 1988.
And all right.
I'm concerned. I don't know what that looks like.
Right.
What would you recommend?
Yeah. Well, you know, we hear about this all the time. People worried their signature won't match, Mike.
Yes, and many signatures do change over time, maybe just with time and sometimes as a result of some type of health issue. I will tell you that two things. One, I would always check before, but we're beyond that. So here's what will happen. If your signature doesn't match, then we will send you a cure notice, especially quickly if you gave us your cell phone number and your email address, and we'll text you or email you. And you can cure your signature with the information that we send you. That's about the best I can do at this point, but you're probably not going to have any problems.
Here's an email about whether or not the Duval County Canvassing Board has to look at some ballots, Mike, that might be questionable or hard to decipher. It's an email from Richard. He says, I'm concerned about how to monitor the Duval County Canvassing Board. According to the city attorney, Jason Teal, the Canvassing Board met and voted to prohibit recording of Canvassing Board activities, and they released a set of rules for observers that appears ambiguous. Cameras, video cameras, and cell phone cameras are permitted by law, but Teal says they will not be allowed. It is important that these sessions be recorded and made available to the public. With the widespread use of mail-in ballots, there will be more ballots in dispute for this three-member, all-white, all-male, all-Republican canvassing board to consider and rule on. I previously witnessed board members in prior elections calling people idiots for voting Democrat, he says. Recording will keep the process fair and open. Okay, so he's referring to you, the supervisor, Mike Hogan, Michael Boylan, city council member, and a local judge. It's my understanding they make up the Duval County Canvassing Board, and you would go over ballots that might where the voter's intent might not be clear. What about concerns from some voters out there that this process isn't transparent?
Well, it's absolutely transparent because our doors are open anytime we are in session, and party members and candidates' representatives are always there. So we're not doing this in secret. The press can come in. One of the reasons that we don't allow filming is we have to show to the people that are in the room the two signatures, the signature that we have on the ballot and the signature that we have in our records. So everybody gets to see those signatures, but signatures in the state of Florida are exempt from public records, so you can't take a picture of it. And so that is the reasoning that Jason Teal, our attorney, says no videotaping in the room. As far as voter intent, the same thing happens. We throw both the ballots up there. The one that came in that was marked incorrectly some way, and the duplicated ballot that we're going to have to make in order to, after we've made the decision on what was the voter's intent. Again, that's thrown off on a screen that's probably 16 feet by 8 feet, and everybody can see it. And our room is open. There's also a window to the room. So it is very, very transparent. As far as the signature matter, the first thing that happens is I have staff that have taken training. They have to now by law. We used to do it because we thought it was the right thing to do. Now it's in statutes. And so they've been trained on verification of signatures. They will look at those signatures, and they will say, oh, that looks fine, and that passes on to be counted. If they don't like it, it's rejected at that point. But then we do a second step. I have two people that have been verifying signatures for years, and they're very good. And so they'll take a look at it. If they think it's good, it goes on to be counted. If they think it's not good, it goes to the cure process, and that gives that individual a chance to cure their signature. And then at the very end, if they don't try to cure the signature or they couldn't cure their signature, then and only then does the canvassing board see it. So you've got the canvassing board is looking at a signature that has been rejected by two different groups and had an opportunity to get it corrected and did not. So everything about the process is fair and definitely transparent.
Thanks for explaining that. Given that this is expected to be a close election and with partisanship at the levels that it's at, what about this caller, or excuse me, this listener's perception of the optics of this, that the canvassing board is made up of three white male Republicans? Why not have a bipartisan canvassing panel just to reassure voters out there who are cynical about the transparency of the process?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. First of all, the canvassing board members do not know the party affiliation of the documents they're looking at. So unless they know the person, they wouldn't know their party, number one. Number two, I'm the one of the canvassing board members by statute. So no one appoints my position. The chief judge appoints a judge, a county judge, and the president of the city council, who is the Democrat right now, appointed Michael Boylan. So it's just, that's the way it happened. And it doesn't have anything. We're never, Melissa, we just don't have the time in an election to be studying, you know, what is this person's party. We're just looking at a ballot, or we're just looking at a signature. We're not looking at what party they may be a member of.
We're talking to Mike Hogan, the Duval County Supervisor of Elections. Lots of tweets coming into the show. People have questions about so many things. Here's one from Kevin. He wants to know, can someone who is registered who turns 18 prior to election day, but after the beginning of early voting, come out and vote early?
I've already had that question as an email just yesterday. No, they have to be 18. And the one I got, the email was he would turn 18 on the 31st of October. That's when he'll be eligible to vote. He can't come to early voting today. But yes, you have to be 18.
You can pre-register to vote, though, as a teen, though, right?
You pre-register at 16, and then we have it you on file. And then the minute you turn 18, we know that, and we send out your voter information card.
Mandy tweets the show, can you ask the supervisor why there aren't even more early voting locations, especially on our local college campuses, UNF and Edward Waters College? And I assume JU, too. What about that question?
Well, we have to follow the statutes as it relates to citing early voting sites. We did use UNF, and we did use Edward Waters back in 2018. I explained to everyone it was a trial because there's already two early voting sites within 2.5 miles from the campus at UNF. And at Edward Waters College, we had a real struggle because it's a private university, and it is not eligible. There was a building there, still is there, Shell Suite, and I learned that building was given to them by the city. It was on lease for, I think, 30 years, and that enabled us to go there. But the turnout was just abysmal. In fact, in the last two elections, 28 days of early voting, less than 1,000 people voted at Edward Waters College. And they were looking for, helping the students. Less than 12% of the votes that were there were students. So it just didn't fit. It's our understanding that they have leased that building now, so we couldn't have gone there if we wanted to. But it did not meet the geographic and the equal opportunity to vote issue that's in the statutes.
I see. So with voting off to a secure clip, what's your final piece of advice for people who plan to take part in this early voting window?
Well, we hope we won't even have to have election day. I'd like to, on November 1st, say, hey, everybody's voted. But it's the easiest time to vote, and it has the greatest safeguards because a lot of folks will come downtown or go to their early voting site and not have their identification. On election day, that's horrible. You're going to have to vote a provisional ballot. Early voting, you've got a chance to rectify that, come back another day. The other thing is that we've noticed that most of the people that are voting at early voting come in prepared with a sample ballot. And they're not reading all those amendments in the booth like they do on election day. And that's when the line starts to get long because we just can't put out enough booths for everybody to be marking their ballots. But those are the things that I really like about early voting. You have a chance to correct an error, and typically you're not going to have the long line.
Right. And as you said, everyone in the county was mailed a sample ballot. Fill it out, bring it with you, and then fill out the real ballot. That way you can help everyone else and keep the lines moving briskly, because in addition to the votes for president, Congress, there are a number of ballot amendments to consider. There's the half-cent sales tax referendum measure on the ballot for local schools and some other things. So if you want to fill out your whole ballot, fill out that sample ballot ahead of time. Bring it with you. Mike Hogan is the Duval County Supervisor of Elections. I know you're quite busy today, so thank you so much for joining us this morning. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Melissa. Yes, ma'am. You have a great day.
You too. Much more still ahead later. The Mosh is on the move. We'll find out why the Museum of Science and History is crossing the St. John's River to build a new museum on the North Bank. That's coming up, but up next.
I think the most important thing to know is the scale of it and how it's changed dramatically the position of the United States from being an importing 60% of our oil to being the largest producer of oil in the world.
A conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Daniel Yergin. It's a look at the world's energy future inside the pages of his new book, The New Map. We'll be right back.
You blink, you reach for that handful of chips, you scroll through social media, it's all happening on automatic pilot. When it comes to being well-informed, being more mindful of where you get your news can make a big difference in how you see the world. To get your information in context, to gain different perspectives, and to understand real issues, choose NPR as your go-to source for election news. 2020 election, it's time to listen.
Here on WJCT News 89.9. Join WJCT, Jacksonville University, and the Jacksonville Environmental Protection Board for ADAPT, the State of the St. John's River. Experts will share their reactions and suggest next moves based on the annual river report. Join us the evening of Thursday, October 22nd. Reserve your free spot for this virtual conversation at adaptflorida.org.
Welcome back. Pulitzer Prize-winning author and global energy expert Daniel Yergin is out with a new take on how energy revolutions, climate battles, and geopolitics are mapping our collective futures. It's a fascinating look at the way energy drives the global economy and our politics. I spoke with him about his new book, The New Map. Daniel Yergin, a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Your book is called The New Map. You see the emerging energy map around the world, I think it's fair to say, as a set of three factors. And of course, this is all unfolding in the middle of this global pandemic. You talk about the rise of shale oil and natural gas in America, the push for like wind and solar, and then also climate politics and climate funding. But if I could, I want to begin with what you write about, which is really interesting. The energy sector in America that revolves around shale oil and natural gas. What do we need to know about this right now?
I think the most important thing to know is the scale of it and how it's changed dramatically the position of the United States from being and importing 60% of our oil to being the largest producer of oil in the world, and the economic impact, the positive economic impact it's had on our economy and indeed on the position of the United States in the world.
And this is more significant than the average American consumer might realize. What are the long-term ramifications of this change in the energy sector?
Well, I think what it's done is it's created several million new jobs. It's improved our balance of payments. It's generated a lot of government revenues. And it's kept energy costs lower for consumers. So I think that's been really important. And then I can see around the world, I have an anecdote in the new map about when I was asked, Vladimir Putin was on the stage with Angela Merkel, and I asked him a question. I mentioned the word shale. He started shouting. And I realized from at me, which is not pleasant, I realized that what it was about was that he sees shale as strengthening the position of the United States in the world in a way we weren't in when we were so highly dependent on imported energy.
And that's obviously not what he wants. So,
no,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
To say the least.
So how does this affect our geopolitics then? How does this all interact?
Yeah, and that's the idea of this new map is sort of the interaction of energy, climate, as you said, those things with geopolitics. It's a big factor in our increasingly strained and difficult relationship with China. It's a mixed relationship we have with it, and it's the most important political challenge that we face in the world in the decades ahead. But it gives us a flexibility. And what I've seen up close is in India. Prime Minister Modi the other day said how energy had become a major new positive factor in the relationship between India and the United States. And in years past, we've had a strained relationship. Now they're buying energy from us, and they like it because it's diversification, and it strengthens their relationship with the United States.
What about renewables, the drive to get to decarbonization of our economy and pursuing alternatives to fossil fuels like wind and solar? I'm talking to you in the middle of National Drive Electric Week happening right now, this whole movement to encourage more Americans to reduce their carbon footprint, particularly in the car that they drive, since that's a big source of emissions around the world. How is this piece emerging?
Well, I think, first let me say it's happening. Wind and solar, our modern wind and solar industries are 50 years old. In the last 10 years, the costs have really come down. I talk about a shale revolution. There's also a solar revolution. Solar is a lot cheaper, remarkably cheaper, partly because of Chinese manufacturing, since 70% of the world's solar panels come from China, but that's a separate question. And wind costs have come down. And utilities are increasingly emphasizing wind and solar in their portfolios. The other thing that's happened is natural gas has pushed coal out, and that's the main reason our emissions are down now to the levels of what they were at the beginning of the 1990s, although our economy has doubled. So whatever the politics are and whatever the two candidates are arguing about, this change is happening. Electric cars, which people thought were, just wouldn't happen, are certainly happening. I have this great picture in the book of Thomas Edison standing next to his electric car, and Elon Musk standing next to his electric car, and it looks like Elon Musk is like the reincarnation of Thomas Edison. The difference is Thomas Edison's never got traction, and Elon Musk has really changed the automobile industry. But just one other thing to mention about emissions. Cars around the world, if you exclude light trucks, produce about 6% of actually the CO2 in the world, man-made CO2, human CO2. The biggest comes from electric power and from heating. And the other thing you see is that China produces twice as much CO2 as the United States does today. So they have a bigger challenge than we do.
Okay. Then how do you see the growing global imperative to decarbonize playing out? And will we even come close to meeting the targets that environmental groups say are necessary to avoid really deeply troubling climate change impacts? The swamping of our coastlines, for example.
Yeah, obviously something that you all think about where you are. I think that we need, it's happening. We're moving in that direction. If there's a Biden presidency, he will certainly get us right back into the Paris Climate Agreement, and that momentum is there. It's a big job to take an $87 trillion economy and change it from one thing to another. I have in the book a section which I call About Energy Transitions, explaining what they are, the complexity. We have a lot of tools we didn't have, but one of the things, and I talk in the new map about a study that we did for Bill Gates' foundation, that we don't have all the technologies we need. And so I think while policies are important, things like you described, drive electric, are important, public opinion is important, technology is what will really make the big difference. And we need to continue to push technologies. As I said, wind and solar took 40 years to really get commercial. We need to push on new technologies to get us to the kind of targets that people have in mind.
And are we running out of time?
I don't think so. I mean, I know some people think that. I think, you know, climate really unfolds over, climate's not weather, it unfolds over 30 years. And so I think that, you know, I mean, I think we're going to do the best we can, but I think that that commitment to science, to innovation, to getting things into the market, that's what will make the real difference. And I think coming out of COVID, we're going to have a challenge because, you know, there's been so much damage to the economy, particularly small businesses. 44% of employment in private sector in the United States is in small business, and you can just walk down the street and you can see the impact. So we're going to need money for recovery, and then also the money for the kind of, you know, climate plans like that Joe Biden has in his program. So, you know, if these things were easy, they would happen overnight. We're going to have more electric cars in the fleet, but, you know, there are 280 million cars now, and 279 million of them run on gasoline in the United States. So, yeah. But I think that more things are happening than people may think is happening, irrespective of who's president, actually.
And that's something to note. Your book tries to map the future, how not only how coronavirus is upending these energy markets, but also how the virus, climate concerns, and other trends are reordering the power map between the big players in the globe, the U.S., Russia, China, and Saudi Arabia, too. What else can we expect as this fight for energy dominance continues to play out around the world?
Well, I think the interaction of those countries, you know, the two biggest consumers, U.S. and China, the three biggest oil producers, U.S., Russia, and Saudi Arabia, that's where a lot of the action will be. And I think we'll see, you know, a lot of China's, what China's doing globally is related to the needs that it has for energy and the fact that it imports 75% of its oil, what we basically are, you know, self-sufficient now. I think what's the deterioration in the relationship with China on both, you know, on both sides is, I would say, is, you know, if you say, if jumps out the pages, it jumps out of the pages, I think, of the new map, that really understanding how this relationship, where it's going, largest economies in the world, the two largest militaries in the world, connected with each other economically in ways that people don't understand. General Motors sells more cars in China than it does in the United States. But the other side of it is our militaries are increasingly sort of focused on each other. So navigating our way through that in a steady way, in a thoughtful way, is going to be the, you know, I think the number one foreign policy challenge for the United States. Countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia that depend upon oil revenues and gas revenues, in the case of Russia, they're going to have problems as the world makes what is inevitably happening, which is an energy transition.
I really recommend everyone pick up this book. It's The New Map, and he is Pulitzer Prize-winning author and global energy expert, Daniel Yergin. Great to get your insights, Daniel. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Melissa. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Well, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and the pandemic is causing some spikes of violence and challenges in helping people seeking refuge. Gail Patton is the CEO of Hubbard House in Jacksonville. Take a listen. Hi, Gail. Good to have you back on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So October is, of course, Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and you have been busy at Hubbard House not only providing shelter for people dealing with domestic violence, but also trying to raise awareness and preparing for a virtual event. So let's begin with the event. What's going to be happening?
Well, I'm really excited about this virtual event. It's the first time we've ever done it, which is true for a lot of people these days. But it is a virtual awareness to let people know not only about the services of Hubbard House, but also to let them hear stories of hope and strength from survivors directly. And because of our generous sponsors, it's something that people can sign on to and register for free, because we really want to get the word out regarding our services, but also for people to really understand how courageous and strong survivors are. And these stories tell that in a very meaningful and personal way. And it's a Facebook Live event. It's on It's on October 22nd at 8 a.m. And if people go to our website, hubbardhouse.org/breakfast, then they'll be able to register for free. And we really encourage everybody to join in, hear the stories, and learn about how you too can help survivors of domestic violence.
People do need to check that out. And let's talk about why a month is set aside to raise awareness about this, particularly in the pandemic. I was curious to ask you if you're seeing an uptick in reports of domestic violence.
For this calendar year, as compared to this time last calendar year, we are seeing an increase in the amount of hotline calls that come in regarding domestic violence. And then JSO also reports that they have seen an increase in the number of domestic violence calls that they're being responding to. And this isn't a surprise, unfortunately, because people are still isolating at home or working from home. People aren't getting out as much as they normally do. So we're talking about the abuser having greater access, prolonged access, whereas on the other hand, the survivor isn't out in the community and able to get to all the resources that they might normally get to if we weren't trying to stay healthy as it relates to the pandemic.
So let's talk about Hubbard House, because it is a resource for anyone in an abusive situation. Many know of your existence and have for many years. We won't disclose where you are because that's not public. But people know that such a place exists in Jacksonville. Can you talk a little bit about everything that happens and the support that's available at Hubbard House?
So when people think about Hubbard House, they often think of the shelter, and they think that that may be the only service we have. Now, it is one of our most critical services, because that's where the people in the most danger for being killed come in to get help. I mean, people living in shelter at a really high risk. So when they come into shelter, they have as many services as they want to make themselves available to, such as counseling, case management, coaching on how to get jobs, helping jobs, assistance with rent if they're wanting to move out on their own. We do counseling with the children as well, and we help people move forward with their education and their job skills. We also have a non-secret place, which is our outreach center, where people can walk in and get help during regular business hours, 9 to 4. And that is at 6629 Beach Boulevard, and it's co-located with our thrift store. And at that, people can step in and just see what is available for them to get help. Right now, during the pandemic, when people come, we have things partitioned off so that people are sitting 6 feet apart who are in the waiting room. And then you also meet with an advocate face-to-face, but there is a screen in between you. We clean down the rooms after each person. And then we also have the opportunity for people, if they don't want to be seen in person, to reach out and be seen virtually, because we're doing that as well through Zoom and on the phone.
So like any other business or nonprofit, you're having to adapt in these times.
Exactly. And what we have found out, which is really exciting, because from crisis comes opportunity, is that we pivoted and we began giving services through a Zoom format. And while we are finding that for some people, that is a better format, even if we weren't facing the pandemic, because they might not have transportation to get to the outreach center, or if they do have transportation, they don't have the money for their gas, or they don't want to drag their children across town to come see us. Now, in the privacy of their own home, when it's safe to do so, they can access our survivors. So even when the pandemic passes, we are really assessing, should we just continue to be doing this? Because we know for some people, this may be a better option for them.
That is so interesting. This pandemic has really highlighted some interesting through lines in our society. So let's bring it back then to the virtual event. Can you remind us again how people can take part?
It's on October 22nd, so that's next week, at 8 a.m. And if they go to hubbardhouse.org/breakfast, you can register, and you can register for free, and you'll be sent the link. It's a Facebook Live event, but you don't have to be on Facebook in order to watch it. And then you can just click on in the morning and hear and see the courageous stories of the survivors who will be speaking.
So check it out, everyone, and always good to hear your voice, Gail. She's Dr. Gail Patton, CEO of Hubbard House, coming to us as we mark Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Gail, thanks so much.
Thank you, Melissa.
And in a moment, why the MOSH, the Museum of Science and History, is on the move. Don't go away.
I'm Robert Scott. I've been a sustaining supporter of WJCT for over 10 years now. I listen to WJCT all the time, and I have since I was a young adult. One of my favorite shows is actually a local show, and that's First Coast Connect. One of the great values, I think, is listeners are invited to call in. By the end of the hour, I'm definitely more informed about an issue. It's also made me think about it a lot deeper than I probably would have. This is WJCT News 89.9.
Though never elected to office, James Baker spent decades shaping policy and politicians. Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for the New York Times, joins us to talk about the former Secretary of State's close and competitive friendship with President George H.W. Bush and about his diplomatic work that reshaped the world. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
As a student at Florida A&M University in the early 1960s, Cordell Petway peacefully protested for civil rights. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Cordell Petway. We'll discuss secret fraternal organizations in Florida and the impact of the 1928 hurricane. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
A lot of big American companies get their manufacturing done overseas. But one of them is seeing some opportunity in part because of what the pandemic is doing.
This need to not have so much inventory.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The future of American manufacturing, next time on Marketplace.
Tomorrow night at 6, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Plan A. In a little over 2 weeks, we'll have a better idea of who the country wants as its commander-in-chief. What's our plan B? Between poll watchers who could intimidate voters and protests that could erupt into violence, what will election week look like on the ground? What steps can we take now to make sure things don't spiral later? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Mosh is on the move. The city's Museum of Science and History says it's going to relocate and build a new facility at the vacant shipyard's property on the North Bank. This is a change of plans because until just the other day, the Mosh said it was going to remodel its current facility across the river on the South Bank. Bruce Fafard is the CEO at Mosh, and he's on the line. Hi, Bruce.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks. This announcement took a lot of folks by surprise. We had been following as you announced plans to raise money to renovate your facility on the South Bank. What prompted this change? Now you say you're going to build a brand new museum on the North Bank.
So this is something that the Board of Trustees has been working on for many months now. When it first became aware of that potential, the evaluation was very extensive, involving not only a number of members of the board, but also architects, designers, several of our important community partners as well. And the determination was made that it was an opportunity to really have a presence on the North Bank, build a museum from the ground up, and really provide a world-class destination for Mosh going forward. We've been known for making some pretty bold moves in the past, and so this is just a continuation of our ability to be an integral part, a community resource, and something that is a destination for Northeast Florida.
Does your plan to relocate to the vacant shipyard's property depend on the future of Metropolitan Park, which is next door? The shipyard's property is owned by the city. Metropolitan Park, right next to that on the North Bank, the Downtown Investment Authority is waiting for approval from the National Park Service to decide if the city can swap Met Park for the shipyard's property to satisfy an old agreement that prohibits selling parkland without a replacement. How does that tie into your plans, and is that what's driving this?
So there's certainly a lot of moving parts, and as I said, this is something that the dialogue started many months ago, and while we don't have a specific time frame, we are in ongoing communications, and we'll collaborate with the city and with DIA to make sure that the exact location is the best location for Mosh and for all parties concerned. It's my understanding that the Metropolitan Park may be resolved in the next 30 to 60 days. And so that'll bring a lot more clarity to this specific location.
Is part of your desire to move across the river to be closer to the development Shad Khan is planning down the street from where you would be at Lot J?
So, a great question. You know, I think the primary motivation is really to be able to have an opportunity to not only increase the footprint of the museum, but also incorporate a lot of things that, for example, interactive components outside where we would be limited in this current space and not, you know, we'd have to really shoehorn and retrofit a lot of the things that we have going on and some of the things that we'd like to do. Certainly it's a benefit to be in that area and have be part of the North Bank and everything that's going on there. I mean, you can envision certainly a family coming, spending, you know, maybe a half a day at the Mosh and then visiting some of the other sports venues in the area, whether they go into a Jaguars game or over at the ball field. I mean, there's just so much potential there for us. We're very excited about being part of that development.
We need to note, too, that you are partnering up with Visit Jacksonville to provide free admission in November for kids 12 and under. You also have a new exhibit, a traveling exhibit called Toytopia. So while you are in your current location, you're encouraging families to come visit you. Yes?
Most definitely. We are very excited for both of those. And it really works out well with Kids Free November to come in and to interact with our new traveling exhibit, Toytopia. We have things like, we have actually the world's largest Etch-a-Sketch. We have a life-size dollhouse. We've got a life-size battleship game, which was one of my favorite games growing up. And so you bring your whole family, and you can play that game amongst many others. So we are very excited for what we have to offer to the community. We're going to continue to bring in exhibits to attract the community and interact with them at a number of different levels.
Bruce Fafard is the CEO at the Museum of Science and History. As they announce plans to move across the river to the North Bank, go to themosh.org for more about the museum. Bruce, thank you so much for being with us.
Melissa, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield runs our digital. I'm Melissa Ross. It is the first day of early voting. You have 2 weeks to vote, or you can wait until Election Day, which is 2 weeks from tomorrow. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day. And when you go out to vote, wear your mask.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.